I apologize, but during the recording of this episode, I had some difficulties with my microphone, so the sound quality is compromised. Welcome to the Back to Movement podcast. I'm your host, Bernadette, and this is the show where we dive into everything you need to know about back pain, fitness, wellness, and movement science. It's all evidence-based, bringing you the latest research along with expert tips to help you live pain-free, move better, and enjoy a life full of vitality and freedom of movement. And today I am extremely excited to welcome Dr. Thiru Anaswamy to the show. Dr. Anaswamy is a tenured professor and the Rocco Ortenzio Endowed Chair at the Department of Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation at Penn State College of Medicine. He is also on the Board of Governors for the American Academy of Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation and has had leadership positions with the Association of Academic Physiatrists and the Foundation for Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation. And I am so excited because today's topic is guideline-based strategies for low back pain. Let's get started. So again, thank you so much, Dr. Anaswamy, to attending in this show. I really appreciate that.
My pleasure. Thank you for inviting me. I'm excited to talk to you.
Thank you. So why is low back pain so common today?
I think there are lots of reasons. Being in the medical profession and doing what you do, we are probably getting a skewed picture of persons with low back pain. We get to hear about it all the time because of what we do. So in a way, is it really more of a back pain? So I think we should always caution ourselves from thinking that way. But I think if for sure there appears to be more people talking about low back pain, more people coming to see their doctors about low back pain. And this might, you know, be a lot of reasons why this is happening. It could be lifestyle changes, as you can imagine, with more sedentary life patterns and activity patterns. It could be due to just an increased amount of stress we all live in, some more than others, some avoidable, some not. It may also be the way we hold our bodies, related to posture and other things. But there is also a tendency, particularly in the Western world, to over-medicalizing low back pain. What I mean by that is low back pain is, in a lot of ways, a normal part of living. Very similar to the experience of aging, the experience of growth. I think the experience of low back pain is not necessarily abnormal. Persistent, severe, or low back pain that is associated with other conditions, neurological symptoms, is not normal. But most low back pain that people experience is probably normal, and it does not need to be medicalized too much. And the other piece to why we think there is a lot more low back pain now than in the past is the medical legal aspect. I think there is the industrial regulations and medical legal nature of low back pain connected with work leads to a lot of people reporting low back pain and getting seeking attention for it because of the rules and regulations, compared to if such rules and regulations don't exist. I mean, don't get me wrong, those are important for worker safety protection, but that might also have a secondary consequence of more people reporting low back pain than if they did not need to require or be required to report it.
I understand. It's very interesting you mentioned posture, because there is research saying that posture itself doesn't cause low back pain or back pain, because first of all, we need to define good or bad posture. People think that good posture is, you need to sit up straight, shoulders back. Imagine sitting like that, sitting like a stick for 8 hours. It's impossible. So what I do believe in that, you know, get up every 45 minutes if you can, move around, change your posture, because your best posture is probably your next posture, right?
All true. We talked a little bit about a sedentary lifestyle, and we end up sitting more often than our bodies are designed for. So it is hard to maintain proper posture, quote unquote, because of our devices around us, the chairs we sit in, the desks we sit in front of, and so on and so forth. So it's somewhat inevitable that we, like you said, hard to maintain the perfect posture all the time, but we need to remind ourselves frequently to do so.
Exactly. And to move. That's usually my advice. Get up, move around, change your posture, wiggle around. If you cannot get up, just move in your chair a little bit, back and forth, move your spine, move your hips. It's because we designed to move.
This is true. I have no argument there.
Yeah, good. So you're saying that lack of movement can contribute to low back pain, right?
I think it is hard to tell what causes what. Is the chicken or the egg situation? I certainly think those two things are in a vicious cycle. You have pain, let's say that came first, and it is normal and natural to restrict movement in response to a new onset of pain. So it's completely understandable, but similar to an expiry date on a jar of milk, your restriction of movement should also have an expiry date of no more than a few weeks. And after that, I think if you continue to restrict movement, what you said will happen is it might make the low back pain worse.
So if someone, for example, woke up with severe low back pain, what do you normally suggest? You're saying that they should be limiting movement for a period of time, or?
I wouldn't advise them to limit movement. Mm-hmm. I would advise them to move as much as tolerable. Mm-hmm. And I think the medical community has certainly evolved from, let's say, 20 years ago, when the advice could have been, and is still so in many parts of the world, bed rest. And so bed rest and restriction of activity is certainly not the most common advice you would hear from evidence-based low back pain providers. Instead, they would say something like what I just said, which is move as much as you can tolerate it. Mm-hmm. And even that restriction, you would try to remove and encourage more movement, like a visit to a therapist or other formal ways to get you back moving after a certain period of time. So you wouldn't want the restriction of movement to happen for more than 2 to 4 weeks.
Mm-hmm. Yes, understand. And it very interesting, again, you said that some part of the world, they still recommend bed rest. I am from Hungary, and in Hungary, they still recommend bed rest. Don't move, just lay down. And unfortunately, that is the recommendation.
Yes, it's very unfortunate. For most low back pain, that is not recommended.
Yes, I agree with that, because you also lose the confidence in your own body. And then let's discuss the difference between specific and non-specific low back pain, because I think that's really important part.
It is important. The terminology, unfortunately, has stuck. The non-specific low back pain and specific low back pain. Really, the main reason why low back pain is classified like that is a failure of the medical community in precisely understanding in every instance what the cause of the low back pain is. So when we don't know exactly what the cause is, we call it nonspecific. So it's really a misleading term. It doesn't mean that it's just there. It just means that we just don't know what's causing it. Every back pain has a specific cause. I don't think there is any such thing as a nonspecific cause. It's just we don't know what it is sometimes. In other instances, we have a reasonable idea where the back pain might be coming from, whether it is coming from an inflamed joint, whether it is coming from a broken bone, or any such actual hard evidence of a source of pain. when we know that there is such a source, we would attribute the back pain to that source, and then it would no longer be nonspecific.
So what is specific low back pain?
So like I mentioned a second ago, low back pain due to specific causes is usually degenerative in nature. A degenerative cause would be something like arthritis, or what we call degenerative arthritis or osteoarthritis. Another degenerative process would be discogenic in nature. So their lumbar spine, which makes the main part of the low back, has vertebrae and discs. So if the discs, which act like shock absorbers for most of the young adult life, are no longer able to provide that function, so they have reduced ability to provide shock absorption, they also degenerate. And when there is degenerative disc disease, that can also be a source of pain. And then there are other structures surrounding both of these, the joints and the discs, that can also contribute to back pain. And that's what would be specific back pain. Nobody calls it specific back pain. You either call it non-specific back pain or back pain due to degenerative, joint disease or degenerative disc disease or something like that.
The degeneration is part of aging. It's human nature, right? So it's absolutely normal to have disc degeneration. Some 15-year-olds can have disc degeneration, and a 70-year-old, maybe they don't have it because they were given a gift not to have disc degeneration. So there is...
This is true. Degeneration is heavily influenced by genetics and hereditary, risk. I inherited bad genes for my low back myself from my parents. So I have degenerative disorder, and I've had it for close to 20 years. Started with some symptoms early 30 years, but I have no low back pain symptoms now. So there is a way, and many people have degeneration and yet no symptoms of low back pain. And there is probably an equal number of people with low back pain that do not have evidence of degeneration. And there is probably an equal number of people that have both evidence of degeneration and low back pain, and are likely have the back pain because of their degeneration. So there is just all combinations of are possible, and there is just no way to know, just because you have evidence of degeneration on your X-ray or MRI, that is what's causing your back pain.
Very interesting. In the beginning, you mentioned that many things can cause low back pain, like stress, anything, mental health, anxiety, even depression. Am I correct that those things can also contribute to low back pain?
I like the word contribute better than cause, so I 100% agree with that. You know, we think a lot of experience, pain is a subjective living experience that humans have. It is not necessarily all biological in origin. So the biopsychosocial model of pain, if you are a believer in that model, then all of the psychosocial factors also contribute to pain. And I believe in that model, and I do agree with you that social stressors, life stressors, plus all of the other biological factors that we have discussed so far can also contribute to back pain.
So when we are treating low back pain, and I'm talking about non-specific, right? Not specific when there is fracture, cancer, or cauda equina, but there is, you just have low back pain. It's really important that we are actually treating the whole person and not just the body part.
Very true. Very true. This is important for all of us in the medical profession who treat patients with low back pain to remember. It is normal and natural for many of us to sort of deviate from that and really go heavily lean on our skill set. If you are a spine surgeon, your skill set is heavily towards spine surgery. If you are a chiropractor, your skill set is heavily towards manipulation. If you are a physical therapist, your skill set is heavily towards exercise. So you have a tendency, each of us, to lean towards our skill set. but we should not do that at the expense of putting the patient first and in the center.
Exactly. I do like manual therapy and chiropractic adjustments. And every once in a while, I do have chiropractic adjustments. But if you only do that, I believe that you are missing out on a lot. If you are only treating your back pain with manual therapy, it's like washing your hands without soap. That's
a good analogy. I hadn't heard that one before, but it's a good analogy.
Isn't that true? Because, and I'm not saying they are bad. They are good. You feel good, you know. But even research says it. And without physical activity, we are talking about, again, chronic low back pain and not specific ones, that it is physical activity is important. And again, work within your pain tolerance, right? Work within your limits.
This is very true, particularly when we enter into chronic low back pain. Chronic low back pain, most people define it as anything persistent back pain beyond 3 months. When it comes to chronic low back pain, sometimes it's hard to separate the pain from the lack of movement or what we call dysfunction or, you know, reduced function. And it is becomes one swirling mess between pain, which makes you limit activity, and limiting activity makes your pain worse. So decoupling those two things, trying to find ways to manage your pain, should be separated from trying to find ways to increase your movement. And if someone is successful in doing that, then they're likely able to improve on both counts, reducing their pain and improving their movement.
Yes, that's true. I see that in my practice too. And what I firmly believe in, do what you can today and slowly increasing the intensity and the volume of exercising. Because I don't think you can go wrong by making your body stronger.
This is true. There is even a step back behind, you know, making it stronger. It is the fear of movement or kinesiophobia that is a medical term or is a technical term for fear of movement, or fear avoidance behavior is another term where it, because they are afraid it might, a particular movement would cause pain, they avoid making that movement. Movement, by moving and focusing on movement, you might address fear avoidance behavior and fear of movement more so than just the act of strengthening. It is the act of moving itself that'll free you from those fears.
It's very interesting you said that, but many people, they think if they experience more pain, they are damaging their tissues.
Yes, and that is the central to this whole concept of kinesiophobia. In chronic low back pain, that is an extremely common problem that you face when people have submitted or evaluated those patients using questionnaires to bring out how much of their back pain might be contributed by this fear of movement. They found that it is an extensive interplay between their nonspecific back pain and that fear of movement. So addressing the fear with specific targeted psychologically informed physical therapy or cognitive behavioral therapy to address chronic pain or any of similar strategies. There are lots of named psychological approaches to managing back pain and movement that have very effective results. In fact, the highest level of evidence is this kind of a multidisciplinary psychosocial approach to movement and addressing fear of movement. There is a high level of evidence supporting those kinds of strategies in reducing both intensity and interference of back pain, as well as promoting movement and improving activity and function.
Yes, that's really important to keep up the movement as much as you can, again, you know, within your pain tolerance. And when should someone with low back pain consider seeing a doctor?
It is a very subjective experience. Pain is a very subjective experience. So I think there, the intensity of pain can be used as a guide before when you see a doctor. But because it's such a subjective experience, it really comes down to what you're able to tolerate. And if it seems or feels unnatural or severe, then I think you should not hesitate to go see a doctor. But more importantly, if you feel or see or notice other symptoms, like neurological symptoms of tingling, numbness, weakness, problems with your bladder or bowel, or if it is more night pain, or if pain during the nighttime is worse than, you know, during the day, things that don't seem normal, then I think you should go see a doctor.
Okay, thank you. And we were touch basing on manual therapy. I have patients, you know, they've been seeing a chiropractor or they've been doing manual therapy for months. And my question is, how effective is to treat low back pain with only manual therapy?
It can be effective. In general, the evidence-based guidelines recommend multimodal therapy. In most instances, the evidence for single treatment approaches is a little bit lower than multimodal approaches. But at the same time, there is more research on single treatment approaches, whether a TENS unit is effective, whether, you know, a series of manipulations are effective, or just exercise training is effective. There are more research done that way because people that are doing that research are interested in that particular intervention. But in reality, in common practice, very few people are recommended just one thing. But unfortunately, there is not enough research supporting which combination of treatments is more effective than another combination of treatments. Mm-hmm. But in general, the more evidence-based treatments you can stack on top of each other, the likelihood of relief or outcome is better.
Okay. So just like there is not one best exercise to treat low back pain, there is not one treatment.
I would agree with that statement, yes.
Okay. Very interesting. Thank you for that. Okay, and how can people can differentiate between discomfort and harmful pain during movement? We touched based on that. You know, some people think that if they are in pain during an exercise or movement, they should stop and they should avoid that movement. So how can people can differentiate when, you know, between discomfort and harmful pain during movement?
I don't think you can conclusively distinguish from that at every instance. So when in doubt, go talk to a medical provider. But most instances of non-dangerous back pain will resolve within a few days or a few weeks. So if your back pain does not resolve with your normal modifications of activity and whatever home remedies you might take, then you should probably go see a doctor. Night pain is not normal. So if you have pain in your back that is worse at night, then you should probably go see a doctor. And I mentioned other neurological disorders or neurological symptoms. If you've experienced them, you should probably go see a doctor. And lastly, if you had trauma or injury or a severe illness that triggered the back pain, then you should probably also see a doctor. But because it could be, like you mentioned before, fracture or it could be an infection, there are other things that can cause back pain than just the back itself.
Yes. Can you tell us the neurological symptoms?
In the low back, as it pertains to low back, typically the neurological symptoms you would want to keep in mind are a symptom of numbness, like it is falling asleep, or symptoms of tingling, or like pins and needles, or burning. A lot of people call shooting pain or sciatica that runs down from their back into their leg. Or weakness, or a combination of all of those weaknesses, things like foot drop, or you have a buckling sensation, or your leg is not as strong and you feel like you're tripping or stumbling, those are signs of weakness. So if you have any or a combination of those symptoms, though, those would be neurological symptoms.
Okay, thank you for explaining that. How stable is the spine and how resilient is it to everyday movements? Because, you know, you are on social media and you hear that, oh, if you bend over this way, you can destabilize your spine. Can you please explain that?
The spine is an extremely stable structure. It is designed for movement, a movement that a human would normally need and experience in their lifetime. And it is designed to prevent excessive movement that might result in injury. So inherently, the spine is a stable structure. Obviously, if you are dealing with abnormalities, such as a spondylolisthesis, which happens when you have, during your growth, you have lack of fusion of the back elements of the bones in the lower back, that is called spondylolysis. That can result in a slippage or instability that's called spondylolisthesis. So if you have anomalies like that, and that is just one example of other anomalies can exist, that can cause structural instability, then obviously your spine is rendered somewhat unstable. Even then, in those examples, it may not be profoundly unstable to the point where you need surgical fixation, but it might be slightly unstable. The more common cause of instability, though, is degeneration. Because we talked about this earlier in the podcast, degenerative joint disease or degenerative disc disease can cause a cascade of events that causes instability of the ligament structures of the spine. And that is the most common cause of instability. So when you're dealing with low back pain in the elderly that have degenerative processes already happening, that can cause what's called degenerative spondylolisthesis, which is the more common type of spondylolisthesis. And there is a lot of variability in which of those need surgical fixation, which of those can be managed without surgery. But going back to your first question, spine is inherently a very stable structure. It takes a lot to make that unstable.
Okay, thank you. And can people with back pain safely engage in physical activity more than they think?
Most types of common physical activity that humans would participate in are extremely safe, and your back is built to tolerate most of those activities. But if you're starting to think like high athletic and risky activities, that would be something in the purview of a highly trained athlete, then that is not something that an average person walking down the road, who does not have the body capacity and training to do so, they should probably avoid those kinds of extreme movements. I'm talking about like back flips and jumping from skydiving and other things. Those kinds of movements are probably inherently dangerous because they would put your body through movement that you have not previously experienced. And there is a higher risk for causing injury from those kinds of movements if you're not properly trained for it.
You said the key thing, not previously experienced. So if you're slowly previously experienced things, gradually going into things, that can also be achievable. I'm not saying backflips, but certain things, if you get used to the movement, it can be, slowly, I'm saying gradually, it can be safe.
Yes, most movement that humans do are safe. Spine can tolerate most movements. I completely agree with that. With training, you can increase your capacity to tolerate movement beyond the normal range for an average human. Along with it comes a little risk, but if you're equipped and you train and you're particular about it, you can reduce the risk of injury from extreme movement.
Yes. And what type of exercises or movements are recommended for people with low back pain?
The common strategy for exercise therapy is stabilization and core strengthening. And there is evidence to support that. There are more specific strategies for activation and of certain muscle groups. And there are some groups of thought, schools of thought, that believe very strongly that these muscles are more important than these other muscles, and so on and so forth. The evidence supporting specific exercise therapy is not great. But in general, exercise therapy for stabilization and core strengthening is generally comes with strong evidence basis behind it.
Yes, as we already touched base on, we shouldn't just treat the body part, we should treat the whole person and the whole body. I firmly believe in that. Not just making your spine stronger or your core, your whole body, right?
This is very true. Spine and the muscles surrounding the spine serve in a very supportive function that allows your legs, your body, and your arms to move a little easier. So the core, as the name suggests, is at the core of all movement. But that also means that if your arms and legs are not strong, and if you have weak thigh muscles, for example, you might be putting excess load and on your back, and your back may not be equipped to take on that load. So absolutely, a stronger body will allow a stronger back, and vice versa.
It's very interesting. I was researching a couple of weeks ago, and on one of the papers, I found that you can actually have low back pain because you picked up something off the floor with using your back and not your legs. And it's very interesting. How can you pick up something without using your back? It's impossible. As a physical, you know, I'm into movement, and you cannot physically pick something up without using your back. It's not the movement, it's the load. Of course, if you pick something heavy, you hurt your back, right?
This is true. So that advice actually has some merit. It essentially alerts you to, you know, reducing the distance away from your body that your object that you're picking up is. The closer the object is to your body, the lesser load it puts on your back. You have to use back muscles when you're trying to pick something off the floor. It's inevitable. So, but the more you share that load with your leg muscles, the lesser the load you're putting on your back. If you're like bending at your waist, you're not using your legs, and the object is way in front of you, it's just the mechanics of the movement. You are putting a lot of load on your back. If you're closer you are to the object, you're just producing. It's just it's basic mechanics
exactly.
Of movement.
And what are the most important clinical guidelines for managing low back pain?
I'm glad you asked me this question. We actually published a couple of papers recently where we looked at all available back pain guidelines, and we systematically appraised their quality. And we looked at 21 different guidelines published all around the world. And we found out, thankfully, that out of those 21 guidelines, based on the scoring and the appraisal that we did, most of them were of really good quality and can be used. The top two guidelines that received the highest score on our paper, on our study, were the low back pain guidelines published by the North American Spine Society and the NICE, N-I-C-E guidelines published by UK. That is evidence-based guidelines published by the, I think, the National Health Service in the UK. But there are all the other 17 or 18 out of those guidelines, out of the 21 that we looked at, were of very good quality, and any of them can be used for following. And the guidelines, to take a step back and just kind of in general comment about guidelines, are a set of recommendations that are based on published literature that gives you, as the name suggests, as a clinician, guidance to treat your patient. You're not really recommended to use the guideline directly and not apply it to the patient that's in front of you. So ideal evidence-based medicine is three things: the intersection of evidence, which is what the guidelines provide, your skills and training, and the patient's values and expectations. The sweet spot between all three of those is what evidence-based medicine is, not just blindly following a guideline.
Okay, that's really important. Thank you. What if these days someone is not following evidence-based medicine or following the guidelines and is treating someone with low back pain?
Well, if you don't follow evidence-based guidelines or evidence-based approach to treatment, likelihood is that you will deviate from standard of care, and the likelihood are that will lead to undesirable outcomes or excessive utilization of resources. So either way, you are not giving high-value care to your patient. Value is a ratio of outcomes and cost. So if you if you don't follow evidence-based principles, you're likely to have less than desirable outcomes or less than desirable cost or both.
And what if someone is treating their patients only based on their experience in the last 20, 25 years?
Experience is extremely important. It allows you to operate at the peak of your ability. It allows you to operate on heuristics, things that come to you without having to think about it too much. And both of those are extremely important, which is why your experience is one of the three cornerstones of evidence-based medicine. But you, as you mentioned before, if you put the patient in the center of your treatment approach, that is two of the three cornerstones: your clinical experience, the patient's values and expectations, and the third being external evidence or evidence-based guidelines. So if you use all three of those, more often than not, you will do the right thing.
Okay. And how were these guidelines developed and what evidence supports them?
Guidelines are generally developed by a work group made up of experts in the field and methodologists like statisticians and librarians. And they have a charge of what they should do. It starts out by asking questions. How do you approach a patient with low back pain? What are the tests that are important to do? How do you evaluate somebody? What are some treatments that are available? Which ones have evidence compared to what? And by asking those questions, then you then search the literature, retrieve the papers, and there is a pretty clear methodology by which you can evaluate the quality of those papers. So if you follow a recommended methodology, such as the GRADE methodology or similar other methodologies, then you can classify the papers based on their quality. And then you use the conclusions from the best quality papers. Mm-hmm. You put them together, synthesize those evidence, come up with a series of evidence-based recommendations. So that is the general process of guideline development.
When you are saying the best papers, or are we talking about systematic reviews, randomized controlled trials, or what do you mean about best papers?
Most of the time, those are the two best quality papers, is because systematic reviews and randomized controlled trials, the results, the conclusions from them are less likely prone to error. So you can have higher degree of confidence that the conclusions of those types of research are more likely true than not. As you go down the evidence ladder, the other types of research papers, such as case reports or personal observations, while they may be true, you also run the risk of sometimes them not being true, that you happen to see a patient that got better this way, but if you have 99 other patients that come through your door, they may not achieve the same result. So there's less confidence in their conclusions. Mm-hmm. As a result, you call the systematic reviews and randomized control trials as higher quality papers. You have more confidence in their conclusions.
Yes, thank you for explaining that. Are there any common misconceptions about low back pain that the guidelines aim to address?
So guidelines are a good way to guide clinicians, low back pain practitioners such as yourself and me, to guide the patient, treating the patient in front of them. But when you're trying to flip that question to what should the patient ask, you need to kind of have conversations about what you shouldn't do. So things to avoid are excessive utilization of imaging, or aggressively pursuing unnecessary procedures, or low value interventions is what we call it. And I previously mentioned the concept of value is outcomes over cost. So there are some low value procedures and low value treatments that either have very low quality outcomes or high quality, high level of cost. And so you might want to have a conversation with your provider whether the treatment that is being recommended has high value or is it of low value.
These days, everyone who has back pain, the first thing they want to do is have an MRI.
Evidence-based guidelines suggest that MRIs are probably appropriate to start talking about after a trial of conservative care defined as physical therapy, exercise therapy, movement therapy, manipulation, etc., and a reasonable trial of like basic medications and activity modification, but not before. So if you have back pain, and like we discussed earlier in this podcast, most back pain is nonspecific and resolves with just a matter of time. So which is why it's unnecessary to obtain an MRI too quickly. As we discussed earlier in the podcast, if you get an MRI and you are anywhere over 20 years of age, you're likely to see something wrong, something abnormal, because we all go through a process of degeneration after we turn 20. Therefore, if you get an MRI too soon, you might be misled into thinking that what you see on the MRI is what is causing the back pain, and that may not be true. So there is a downside to getting an MRI too quickly, but you don't want to wait too long either. So if you, after an adequate trial of conservative care and a passage of time for about a month or two, if your back pain is not better, it's reasonable to get an MRI then.
True. And it's very interesting you mentioned that you find something on the MRI, because many people find that, oh, they have a disc herniation. And we all know that even pain-free people have disc herniation. And disc herniation itself, they heal without doing anything.
All true. More commonly is the disc bulge that is completely asymptomatic. Disc herniation that's asymptomatic is slightly less common than a disc bulge, but you're absolutely spot on. Many of them should be put in context. The MRI findings should be put in context with what's going on with the patient. Without that context, it is extremely misleading.
Yes. And what role do lifestyle factors like, diet, stress, and sleep play in managing low back pain?
They play a very vital role. You mentioned earlier in the podcast, you take a holistic approach, a patient-centric approach, and a biopsychosocial approach. We talked about that. So if you do not address all of those issues, those factors, lifestyle, posture, movement, modifiable risk factors like smoking, you are not doing service to your patient. So all of those things have to be addressed as well in order to provide a more comprehensive, holistic approach to back pain treatment.
And how can patients best communicate with their healthcare providers to ensure they receive guideline-based care?
That's a very good question. I'm not sure if there is a clear way a patient can evaluate whether their provider, their doctor is following guideline care. There are quality metrics that are published that's available in public domain like Medicare that might give you an idea if the quality metrics attributed to your provider are high. Chances are they're following evidence-based care, but there is no guarantee. I don't think we have a foolproof way of knowing whether your provider is following evidence-based medicine. I would advise the patient to have an honest conversation with their provider to figure out if they follow evidence-based principles in their care. So injections to treat back pain are, when used appropriately to address evidence-based sort of specific back pain, like due to a specific known source of the pain that is confirmed on procedures or diagnostic imaging, etc., can be very effective. A lot of back pain is episodic. What I mean by that is once you develop back pain doesn't mean you have back pain for the rest of your life that needs repeated treatment. Most back pain is episodic. So these injections can be effective in managing that episodic back pain. If you think one injection or a series of injections would treat back pain for good and they will not have back pain again the rest of their life, that would be that would just not be a fair expectation.
Okay. Even if the patient has chronic low back pain?
Chronic low back pain, by its nature, by its definition, is persistent and not necessarily episodic. So it doesn't come on with a certain episode and then go away. So it can be injections, interventions to address pain can be effective in what I call reducing the pain burden. Mm-hmm. It needs to be clubbed or paired with other advice that promotes movement, promotes activity, in order to be more effective. So just injection alone is unlikely to effectively manage back pain for good. You need to combine it with other approaches that also addresses all of those other things that's going on with your patient.
That's what we talked about in the beginning of the podcast. One treatment, one like manual therapy itself, or even physical activity, you know, you have to combine you have to combine it with other treatments.
Very true. If you don't address back pain and you tell the patient to move and they experience pain, one of two things will happen. They'll either stop coming to you or they will find something that works for back pain. So you have to address both. You cannot be without addressing the pain.
Of course.
You cannot be without addressing the movement. So you have to address both.
Yeah, absolutely. I definitely agree with that. Okay, thank you so much, Dr. Ranaswamy, and thanks for the listeners to listen to the Back to Movement podcast with your host Bernadette and with our very special guest, Dr. Ranaswamy. I hope you enjoyed this episode and all the insights you learned about guideline-based care for low back pain. That's all for this episode, folks. See you next time.
Thank you very much. It was my pleasure talking to you, Bernadette.
Thank you.